Russia's upper house of parliament votes unanimously in favor of giving President Vladimir Putin authority to deploy troops to Ukraine's two breakaway regions. The EU says it's seeking to impose sanctions on banks financing Russian operations in Ukraine's separatist territories and Moscow's access to European financial markets. Israeli forces attack a young Palestinian boy suffering from Down syndrome in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the occupied Al-Quds. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now let's begin with tensions over Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has ratified friendship treaties with the two self-proclaimed People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk in eastern Ukraine. Now that after Parliament approved the recognition of the two breakaway regions earlier on Tuesday, the upper house of Parliament has also approved a request by Putin to deploy armed forces abroad. Moscow says the move will pave the way for sending what it has called peacekeeping missions to the breakaway regions. On Monday, Putin recognized the independence of Donetsk and Luhansk, accusing the Western-backed government in Kiev of committing genocide there. The Russian Foreign Ministry has also urged other countries to follow suit, saying that a move was the only possible step.
The Ukraine crisis is entering a new phase as Russia recognizes the independence of two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine.
I consider it necessary to make a long overdue decision to immediately recognize the independence and sovereignty of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic.
Putin has also issued an order to deploy peacekeepers to Donetsk and Luhansk. Russia has already denied any plans to attack Ukraine or annex the two regions. The Russian president justified his decision by accusing the West of cheating Moscow and dishonoring their promise to stop NATO's eastward expansion.
They simply fooled us. We had five stages of NATO expansion, one after another. It has impacted very negatively on the nature of international relations and led to the loss of mutual trust.
Putin reiterated that Kyiv's admission to NATO would pose a major security threat to his country. The comments provoked Kyiv's reaction.
Ukraine unequivocally qualifies the recent actions of the Russian Federation as a violation of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of our state.
Hours later, the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting on the situation. Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. clashed head-to-head at the meeting.
The internationally recognized borders of Ukraine have been and will remain unchangeable, regardless of any statements and actions by the Russian Federation.
What is more, this move by President Putin is clearly the basis for Russia's attempt to create a pretext for a further invasion of Ukraine.
We remain open to diplomacy for a diplomatic solution. However, allowing a new bloodbath in Donbass is something we do not intend to do.
Russia has warned Western powers to think twice and not worsen the situation, but the West's reaction was nothing other than critical remarks and threat of sanctions against Moscow. The Kremlin accuses Ukraine and the West of violating the Minsk agreements. It says the government in Kyiv is committing genocide in the Donbas region, while the West sends offensive weapons to the country. On the other hand, the West claims Russia intends to invade Ukraine. The Minsk agreements were signed in 2014 and 2015 to secure a ceasefire between the Ukrainian government and pro-Russian forces in the east of Ukraine. The Kremlin has repeatedly expressed concern about NATO's eastward expansion, demanding a ban on Ukraine's admission to the military alliance. So far, the U.S. and its NATO allies have only blown on calls by ignoring Russia's concerns and its requests for security guarantees.
Russia's recognition of the two breakaway regions in Ukraine has led to widespread reactions and ramifications. Ukraine is now reconsidering cutting off diplomatic ties with Russia. It's recalled its senior diplomat from Moscow for consultation.
I have received a request from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to examine the question of breaking off relations between Ukraine and the Russian Federation. I will examine and work on this issue right after the press conference.
The Ukrainian president also accused Russia of preparing for a military aggression, but played down the prospect of a large-scale conflict. Zelensky has called on his Western allies to quickly impose sanctions on Russia. In particular, urged an immediate halt to the approval process of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline designed to carry Russian natural gas to Germany. In response to the Russian move, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz already took steps by halting the certification of the multi-billion-dollar pipeline project.
I have asked the German Economy Ministry today to withdraw the report on the analysis of energy supply guarantees from German regulator Bundesnetzagentur. It sounds technical, but it's a required procedure so that there can be no certification of the pipeline now. Without this certification, Nord Stream 2 cannot become operational.
Well, the UK also saying it will impose sanctions on five Russian banks and three high net worth individuals. The UK, alongside Austria, has summoned Russian ambassadors too. The European Union is also reportedly close to agreeing on sanctions. The measures include putting politicians and officials on blacklists, banning trading in Russian state bonds, and targeting imports and exports with separatist entities. Iran, meantime, has called for restraint on all sides, saying that any measure that leads to the escalation should be avoided. Tehran says U.S.-led NATO's provocative and meddlesome moves have complicated the situation in the region. Now, we talked to political commentator Christoph Herstal for his take on that situation, and he believes that Washington is pulling the strings around the administration of Ukrainian President Zelensky.
Well, I do think that what the esteemed Ukrainian President Zelensky has said is directed at his own people. But unfortunately, his country has lost sovereignty to Washington. He's not in full control. The CIA is controlling his country, and they're pushing Ukraine against Russia. It was a very sad story that last Friday, the Yamal oil pipeline delivering oil to Germany, France, and others was hit by the Ukrainian army. They're using against the Minsk peace contract, they're using Turkish Bayraktar drones to kill people in Donetsk. These are the stories we are facing since a long time. There's an escalation on the border. Half of the Ukrainian army of 125,000 men is now concentrated on the demarcation line to Donbas. So this is the situation we face, and unfortunately, NATO has become a gang of scoundrels, and the NATO governments rule against their own people.
Now, escalating tensions between the West and Russia over Ukraine tumbled global stocks and sent crude prices to their highest in 7 years. The pan-European stock 600 plunged to a seven-month low to nearly 2%. German shares in particular shed more than 2% over uncertainties due to the country's heavy reliance on Russian gas. International benchmark Brent crude futures soared to nearly $100 a barrel, the highest since 2014, amid concerns over a possible disruption in energy exports. U.S. stock index futures also nosedived after Russia's recognition of two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine. The MSCI World Index traded at its lowest since late January. Investors sell off stocks and riskier assets amid fears of the prospect of a major war in Europe. Time now for the news review section. Israeli forces have attacked a young Palestinian boy suffering from Down syndrome in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the occupied Al-Quds. The boy, identified as Muhammad al-Ajlouni, was brutally attacked along with other residents. They had gathered in solidarity with families threatened with expulsion from their homes. According to eyewitnesses, the crackdown left a number of people wounded. Palestinians have long been voicing anger at Israel's forced expulsion from their ancestral homes and the regime's demolition drive in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israeli forces have intensified crackdown on Palestinians protesting the regime's atrocities in Sheikh Jarrah and other neighborhoods. Now, to discuss this a bit more, I'm joined by a couple of guests, Simona Candilar, correspondent in Ramallah, also Amal Wahtan, human rights advocate and Palestinian activist, joining us from Ramallah, too. Good to see you, ladies. So let's go to Mona first. Tell us more about this story and the overall situation in the occupied territories. As you've been reporting, and we've also been covering this, Palestinians are angry, and it seems that they are in the right. They should be angry, naturally, with what's going on there on the ground.
Well, this time the situation is a little bit different and something completely different. When we are speaking Palestinian youth with Down syndrome, we have to say that the face of a person with a Down syndrome is apparent, even to the Israeli soldiers, even to anyone. What happened, according to the Israeli military, the Israeli soldiers, that this young Palestinian man, Muhammad Al-Ajlouni, was chanting Allahu Akbar, Allah is great, during a demonstration that was held against the forced eviction of Palestinian families from Sheikh Jarrah. The Israeli soldiers were angry, and they were, let's say, touched by the chanting Allahu Akbar. They followed him, they dragged him, as the video was clear. People were trying to comfort him, to take him from the hands of the Israeli soldiers. It was very clear that Muhammad Al-Ajlouni was terrified, was being attacked and harassed. The Israeli soldiers had crossed all red lines, according to the experts and to observers. Those Israeli soldiers who carried out this attack should be immediately dragged to a trial, according to many here, of course, are demanding. We have to mention that a Palestinian man with Down syndrome or with disability was killed by the Israeli soldiers in Al-Quds several years ago. The Israeli soldiers at that time said the soldiers ordered him to go back, and he didn't obey their orders. At the end of the day, he was shot dead. But apparently, he didn't understand what they were saying.
Okay. Now, Amel, if you allow me, let's review some comments that people have posted on social media, and then I'll get back to you with my question for you. So let's check out social media. Okay, we have Tenisina Marwa saying, speechless. Israeli forces attacked and arrested Muhammad Al-Ajlouni, a young Palestinian with Down syndrome from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. They're brutally targeting Palestinian civilians, regardless of their age, gender, or ability. Then we have the Palestine saying that you're a Palestinian, then you're in danger of being oppressed with countless crimes, no matter if they're children, women, elders, or even people with special needs. Israeli occupation forces keep committing brutal crimes against Palestinians. Mohammed Salami says that the entire world must see how the terrorist occupation troops of hashtag Israel are attacking a Palestinian young man with Down syndrome. Zionists are the Nazis of the time. And also we have Cato saying that sadly the world continues to turn a blind eye to the ongoing brutality of Israel's illegal occupation and apartheid regime. Okay, now Amal, so you see what the situation is. Just like Mona said, and you've been also witnessing this, they're just attacking Palestine no matter if they're healthy, if they're disabled, and you know, this young man with Down syndrome. And this is the way they treat the Palestinians. And at the same time, we have this land grab thing and the demolition of Palestinian homes, especially Sheikh Jarrah recently. And also we have the world bodies like the UN simply protesting and asking for the Tel Aviv regime to stop this. So what's your overall assessment of this situation? What's going on?
Well, this indiscriminate abuse against Muhammad Ajlouni and others who are disabled or sick, we have seen it several times. They don't give or they don't give a damn about Palestinian lives, whether they're children or women or elderly. They don't. Actually, this proves that all the reports that has been published regarding the nature of this system, the apartheid crimes that are committed shows that these soldiers are acting according to orders that they've given by their superiors, whether in the military or in the government. The government that allows one of the, their Knesset members to open an office in Sheikh Jarrah just to provoke the people, just to make people's lives miserable, and try to pressure them to leave Sheikh Jarrah, which of course they wouldn't leave Sheikh Jarrah as they did in 1948 when they left Haifa and when they left Western Jerusalem. This shows that it is a coordinated effort between the different levels of the Israeli and the Zionist establishment. So whether it's the UN or the EU, they cannot solve this problem unless they have a real pressure on the Israeli government. Actually, the U.S. has to exert this pressure against the Israeli government. Otherwise, we're going to have another round of May, Saif al-Quds in last May. So they have to choose whether they want to go with this route, mm-hmm. with a large-scale confrontation with the Palestinians in 1948 in the West Bank, Jerusalem, and Gaza, and whether they want to withdraw from Sheikh Jarrah and leave the residents alone. There is a thing, not uproot them like 48 or in confrontations with the Palestinians. So this is in the hands, actually, of the Israeli government. From what we are seeing, we know that the Israeli no intention of withdrawing from Sheikh Jarrah or any other neighborhood in Silwan, or stopping the settlers from barging into Al-Aqsa Mosque day in, day out. And this is not actually which opens the other military and popular resistance and intifada in the West Bank and 1948 territories. This is the only choice that is left for the Palestinians, Israeli establishment, the Zionist establishment. The prisoners movement as well are facing another wave of aggression, and they're using all the methods that they have to confront this aggression. So in every part of occupied Palestine, Palestinians are confronting different methods of aggressions by the military and by the police. So where neither the UN or any other or international organization can do something about it. It has to be a political political pressure exerted by the U.S. And the EU will follow, of course, the U.S., or to go to the other option of a large-scale confrontation.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that, Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah, and Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate and Palestine activist, also in Ramallah. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, selecting role model. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of selecting role model for our kids when we are raising them in the Islamic lifestyle. Now, it is very necessary that we should be aware of the criteria of selecting a role model. Obviously, when we hang out with the people, when we socialize with the neighbors, with the relatives, maybe in the mosque, maybe in the Husseiniya, where you go, and obviously in the days of Muharram and the days of Ramadan or the weekends when we go there, we need to be careful that whatever we do or with whoever we socialize or we have relationship, our kids gonna have the same relationship. And kids are the ones who are recording all our activities, even when the child is at the stage where it is in the womb of the mother. And even when it is delivered, it is in the lap of the mother. This child can see everything and is observing everything. And every single action of the parents have effect on this child. Therefore, in order to select a good role model, we need to have a good role model and to follow that so that our kids can see the followership of that role model in their parents, and then they can follow their parents, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of selecting role model. And we said, obviously, the kids, they see us, they follow us. And especially the boys, they follow the fathers and the daughters follow the mother. Therefore, we as a parent should have a good role model. And in order to select a role model, we need to know about the criteria. For example, that the role model which we chose for our own selves, this role model should be in a way a person who is perfectly or is trying to follow the Islamic teachings. Therefore, those who are perfect in following the Islamic teachings are the Prophet and the infallible Imams. And that's why they are the role model. And Allah has made them the role model for us. Therefore, it is necessary for the parents to know about the life of their Prophet, to know about the life of the infallible Imams, to know about the life of Hazrat Fatima Zahra Salaamu Alayha. And if we know about them, if we know we have read the history, not heard the history, if we have read Read means reading the books of history to know what they were doing and how they used to live. Generally, we hear from the scholars. So we should have the habit of researching, reading the books. So if we read about their life, if we are trying to follow what they have said and the way they lived, then obviously we can be the good role models for our children. And then when they see us living a good life, an ethical life, a life which is full of love, full of peace, full of spirituality, they will also follow the footsteps of their parents, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
British sport is once again under fire, and for an all too familiar problem, racism. This time the story flared up in English cricket, when one Yorkshire cricketer, Azim Rafiq, revealed to a parliamentary committee that in his experience racism, without a shadow of a doubt, was widespread. He also claimed that, instead of facing up to the need to deal with it, abuse from his colleagues was not tackled and instead treated as a joke or friendly banter.
Giving evidence to the Parliamentary Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee, Azeem Rafiq stated English cricket is institutionally racist. He recounted the inhuman treatment he endured after his son was still born in 2017. Also, according to Rafiq, in cricket, racist language was used constantly, never stamped out, and the norm, and people didn't think it was wrong. Similar issues have also been reported in English football, with visibly ethnic players repeatedly enduring abuse from the terrace and from other players. The impact has been relentless and corrosive. In Azeem Rafiq's case, he believes he lost his career to the effects of racism over a prolonged period. However, former footballer John Barnes, who echoes the concerns and revelations of Azeem Rafiq, does not think the impact of such revelations will be an end to the issue. He believes institutions will just scapegoat people and think we're making a change by increasing ethnic representation in sport.
Why, after all these years, do racism and other forms of ethnic abuse appear to remain endemic in British sport? And what message does it send out to fans who watch from the terrace and see this sort of behaviour on the pitch? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. To what extent should sports people in the United Kingdom feel able to compete completely free of any form of racial abuse? We put that question to the public here outside London's iconic cricket ground, the Oval. Here's what they said.
Anyway, that's another story. Let me just ask you the questions.
Ready?
Okay. So there's no test of knowledge. I'm just going to fire a couple of questions and see what you think.
You're welcome.
We're here at Oval today. And
we're here today at the Oval. Yeah. And we're asking the public the recent allegations of racism in sport.
Sorry.
No. First question. To what extent should sports people in Britain be able to compete without racist abuse?
Yeah, of course there shouldn't be no racism at all.
I mean, it sounds extremely unfair that for so many, they do end up going to play and just get heckled, and their focus is drawn away from the sport that they're playing, and suddenly their identity is being attacked.
Well, there's no racism, there's no discrimination of any kind. Everybody just kind of gets brought together. That's what I love about sport.
Well, of course, you shouldn't have to worry about anything like that. You know, sport is sport. They shouldn't have to, any of those sort of issues shouldn't come anywhere near the sport, you know.
To what extent do you think that British sports people should be able to do their sport without any fear of racism or religious discrimination?
Oh, 100%.
Why?
Well, because it's not relevant to the sport that they're playing.
I know nothing about cricket, but what I know is that it's completely international, it's all over the world, so that's beautiful. It's something that should bring people together, not apart.
Yeah, of course. Like, I think racism and all this stuff... it's been like, you know, for ages.
It's a great shame. It's something that's an ongoing battle by all accounts.
I'm from abroad. I can't imagine there's racism in British sports.
I believe racism is inborn.
Yes.
It's not avoidable easily.
Do you think that British sports people should be able to compete without fear of racist abuse?
I do. Unfortunately, it's very rife and has been for a very, very long time.
They said something on the news this morning. There's this whole thing about people excuse racism by saying it's banter. And this whole thing about bants that has suddenly become a byword for I can get away with saying anything. Oh, just bants, which it's not.
In reality, there is still racism ongoing. We know that is true. There's racism ongoing.
In the honesty of all of it, there shouldn't be any fear of it. I think we've come a long way. Like, British history in regards to colonialism has come a far, long, long, long way. 21st century, there shouldn't be any fear.
To be honest, I don't think any racism I observed.
Absolutely, yeah. It isn't just racist abuse, it's about sexist abuse, it's about inclusion. Everyone should be able to get to the best that they can possibly be.
People should be able to freely participate in any sport.
How does the public feel about cricketer Azeem Rafiq and footballers claiming that British sport is institutionally racist.
Institutionalised? I'm not really sure. I wouldn't be able to give a definite opinion on that, but I mean, I can understand that there might be some elements to suggest that.
I think we've been letting it go on for too long, and in that sense it is institutionalised, it's part of the system.
In my standard and in my understanding, it was so exaggerated, and I disagree with you.
I couldn't tell you much about it, to be fair, Paul, but I did see a little bit, and as the case obviously needs to get stamped out.
Everyone that is racist or thinks racism should belong somewhere, wherever it might be, should not exist, in my opinion. Like, honestly, just change your mind. It's not a thing. It's 2021. Get over it.
That's kind of disappointing because we're at like 2021, so we'll be we should be able to do whatever we want.
It's sad. You know, the fact is that we try to combat so many different elements, but it's still there.
There's one expression here in English language saying this is not cricket. So this means to me cricket is a very, very fair sport, and it's to me open-minded to everybody.
Racism is not a good feeling. The outcome is horrible. People should really accept everyone.
I've lived in this country for about 40-something years. My family live in Australia. And I've always gone on about, in Australia, the racism, the sexism, the homophobia was always in your face. So you knew it was there and you could deal with it. In this country, there's a whole veneer of politeness. I didn't realize how misogynist men were in this country. It took me about 10, 15 years to work it out. And if I think that's the same thing, I think that's probably the same with racism.
I'm not surprised to hear about that because I know that racism is many places in this country. It's practicable many places, both secretly and openly. We know of that.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was institutionally racist, but I think it's got opportunity to grow. You know, he would know more about it because he's in the field. But yeah.
And it makes me feel sad, but at the same time, it's just the reality. I mean, the British, the UK is quite institutionally racist.
I think it's been acknowledged that there is a massive problem that needs to be addressed. It may be not just in our sport, it might be across the culture of the country. But we're definitely going to deal with it.
Why is there still so much racism in British sport, is the public's opinion.
Just because England has got such kind of deep tradition, deep culture, especially with kind of like the British Empire colonialism only ending about, what, like 50 years ago.
I wish I knew. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing. I know, I'm lucky I don't experience anything like that myself, but I imagine it's terrible.
Don't know why. It could be jealousy. They earn plenty of money.
I think there was just an unawareness of, you know, what multiculturalism actually meant.
I couldn't tell you the reason why. I don't think it's sport specific, but I think obviously with the emotions of sport, it comes maybe comes out a little bit more. But either way, it's got no place.
Because sport is just, you know, a microcosm of of society.
To be honest, I think it's always been there. It's just like now we have more voice to say. Like before, as you say, we've been like a lot of people, a majority has been living with fear. And now we know, like, we are actually 2021 and we'll be able to express ourselves.
Because I think it's something that is institutionalized, unfortunately, that goes back many, many years.
When people are good, people have reason to pick on them. If people can't be like you, they want to antagonize you. As simple as that.
I think it's always been there and always will be. Hidden under the carpet, brushed under the carpet, whatever you call it. But I think it will always be anti-this, anti-that.
It's something of mine, because I know black people have contributed a lot to this country. You see, when black people do things good, they will say they are British. But when they commit crime, then they'll say they are Nigerians or they are Afghanistan or they are from Ghana.
I think the irony is fair, like, and that's the irony to the first question you asked, if there should be any fear around it. I think all racism comes from just fear, it's just ignorance.
I think, British people, they are very sporting, very sporting-oriented people. And I read that is oil from my side.
They have this imperialist domination of the world that they show in the news and everywhere, and so that they think that also, they are entitled to discriminate other because their country discriminate other countries.
I think it's culture. I think the difficulty is culture, is that maybe that communities aren't encouraged to mix and understand each other.
Research by the Professional Cricketers Association revealed 25% had witnessed or experienced racism. Among ethnic cricketers, that figure rose to over 58%. 45% said it came from another player, with 39% saying it came from fans or on social media. 62% said it was disguised as banter. In football, using pre-COVID data, reports of racism rose by 43% between 2018 and 2019, with faith-based discrimination, including Islamophobia, going up by 75%, more than any other form of abuse. Over 70% of fans across England now think professional football in the country has a serious problem with racism.
We asked the public, what impact does racism on the pitch have on racism in the audience?
I think that professional players in any sport, cricket, football, anything, they need to be role models, they need to be better, because they need to understand that their behaviour on the pitch is going to be emanated by thousands, by millions, potentially, of fans.
I think it's completely dependent on the fan. I mean, if the fan is anti-racism, it's devastating. If they are a racist, suddenly their minds, their way of thinking is actually being backed up, and they're suddenly believing it to be acceptable.
The fans, they are not the very educated people, or there's so many different mixed group. Yeah, some of them maybe they are idiot or they say some things, but we cannot accuse whole the country because of some idiot in the fans. We cannot say that. Yeah, it could be.
Do fans take their lead from players, what they see on the pitch? Is that, there's an influence there?
I don't think so, but you never know. Everyone's totally different, but I don't think so. I don't think you see anyone specifically going from players themselves.
If you're a public figure, you influence people in the bad way and the good way. You get influenced by them.
Well, I'm assuming that the majority are going to be appalled if they see anything like that on the pitch. But then there's always going to be percentage that are like, thanks for, raising that I am a bigot and I want to be able to voice my bigotry. So, yeah.
I think in certain way, yeah, it could influence a lot. Because, it depends of your mentality also, of your backgrounds.
There's still a lot of people out there that have their own views and try to put their views onto other people.
It affects people in different ways. Why is that? Because there's a certain, I'd say, middle class, establishment, whatever. There's this thinking that's that English exceptionalism. Get over it, guys,
Sometimes it makes potential immigrants to feel unsafe to come to this country. And at the same time, it makes many of us too, who have more things to contribute to the society, to reserve some and say, no, I better go and contribute this thing in another country where I feel I'll be safer and I will not experience such kind of racism that is obtainable here.
The racism on the pitch, if it's not addressed, it's legitimized,
We asked the public to comment on their view about what racist abuse in sport tells us about the state of racism in Britain.
I'd say that in sports, kind of like the true nature is brought out when you're kind of cheering for your fans, cheering for your team, and it can get a bit crazy. I think that if there is racism there, it does show a lot about kind of what's in the true nature of British people, and it's quite sad to see that as well.
There's clearly like a plague, a virus of racism that still you know, is deep embedded in the system, and it shouldn't be there. It should, you know, should be out, you know, something that players shouldn't have to worry about, and not something they have to, you know, worry about when they come to do the thing they love doing.
Well, I think it's a reflection of where we are as a society in some respects. I don't think it's any better or any worse, actually. I mean, I think... I was just reading this morning that the incidence of stop and search of black people in London has gone up by 24%.
It's not nice, it shouldn't be happening, and the fact that it keeps popping up is disgraceful.
Well, it doesn't say anything nice, but it's not like other countries don't have it. Like, it's not a British problem, it's, I think it's a problem that every nation has, whether it's in sports or, I don't know, the show business, anything public.
No, it's the same all across the world, I think. Don't matter just this country. It might be more publicised in this country, but it happens all over the world.
They always try to help me, and that's, I think, is another face of, like, London or, like, UK. Because, yeah, I have all this stuff that you're saying, but I also experience, like, the way that people help me a lot, and people has been being so helpful.
Well, Britain knows is there, is the head, and people are looking over, you know, up to them for good behaviour and really giving people the satisfaction they want and tackling things like racism as it should be. So they should do better than this.
So what does racism in sport say about racism in Britain on the international stage?
Well, it's worrying, isn't it? It is worrying.
It gives a very negative reputation about the British society. The British society is a good place, it's a nice place to stay, to live, an organized society. But I think there are a few members of the society here who are practicing such racism that seems to be done by majority of the society of Britain, which is not the majority that practice that racism. It's just a few of them, but it's just that the few people that practice the racism here, they are dominant. That is the thing.
I think Britain is not as racist as other places. However, is it perfect? No. So it is a landmark, but it's got some stains on it, so it can be cleaned.
You know, the UK is part of the United Nations Security Council, and we've seen how they have undermined other countries at the international level, you know, with their culture, you know, the capitalistic, vicious capitalistic domineering culture, and it just transpires at the local level.
Yeah, I think the world is watching. The world is watching to make sure that we change our processes, and it's within cricket today, the meeting of every county board, all aspects of cricket has come to a conclusion that things need to change and things need to, and we need to engage with people. We need to actually engage and say, how can we make this right?
The evidence given by cricketer Azeem Rafiq confirms what many cricket players, footballers and other sports people have known for years. Racial abuse in Britain is widespread and committed by both players and fans. Many have their own stories of abuse to tell and can confirm that racist behaviour is frequently dismissed as a joke or not taken seriously by the organising governing bodies of the sports.
These damaging revelations of a culture of racism in cricket, football and beyond suggest a deeply established presence of religious and ethnic abuse in British sport. And despite words of outrage from sports bodies and politicians, it still continues after all these years. Either because, at least until now, the sporting world couldn't put a stop to it, or because, quite simply, it hasn't cared enough to really try.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.